Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles. I'm the host of this podcast, and I hope you enjoy it. Did you know that about 11% of the world's population has genetic kidney disease? That is 875 million people. We were live at the 61st European Renal Association in Stockholm, Sweden last week. We had an opportunity to talk with Professor John Sayer from the University of Newcastle in the UK, together with Professor Roman Ulrich Müller from the University Clinic Cologne in Germany. We talk about how one-third of all renal failure is attributable to faulty genes, such as the deletion of NPHP1. And we also talk about the ethical considerations of sequencing all babies at birth. But first, I wanted to focus a little bit on the biggest news that came out of the ERA meeting this year, and that was the FLOW trial. And I'm going to talk about that first, and then we're going to go on to this great interview. So enjoy listening. At the ERA, no fewer than 5 talks were dedicated to the FLOW trial. Now, the results were actually quite surprising, and the official results for the FLOW were just published during the ERA meeting in the New England Journal of Medicine. And just to remind you, the FLOW trial was a semaglutide kidney trial, and that ended early last year. And the trial was actually shut down early last year because the results were so good. The FLOW trial looked at over 3,000 people who had type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease, and people were either put into 1 milligram of semaglutide or placebo groups, and they were monitored for an average of 3.5 years. So what was found? Well, they found that a 24% reduction in major kidney disease events, and that means that fewer people were progressing to the point of kidney failure where they were going to need kidney transplants or dialysis. There were fewer deaths from kidney-related causes, and the loss of kidney function was also slowed down. That's not all. There were also 18% fewer major adverse cardiac events, so that means 18% less heart attacks, strokes, and cardiovascular death. Death from any cause was also 20% lower in the semaglutide group. So what we can say for sure here is that the people who have type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease, semaglutide actually helps their kidneys. And a lot of people want to know, well, were these benefits that we're seeing are actually because of the semaglutide itself, or is it because of the reduction in food intake and body size? Because there was significant weight loss as well in this. The authors actually did address this question, and they said it's likely multifactorial, because we know that reducing body size can improve the risk factors for heart disease and chronic kidney disease. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg story. For example, if you're treating the diabetes and the high blood pressure that is hurting the kidneys, then you could help improve the kidney function. However, in this study, the authors note that the effects of semaglutide on the kidneys were unrelated to changes in body size. There are receptors for GLP on the kidneys, and the medications may be directly interacting with those receptors, helping to reduce inflammation and oxidative stress. Really fascinating and a highly impactful study that will be changing practice for sure. Anyway, welcome to the era of GLP-1 inhibitors. Thank you both for being here. We are at the ERA in Stockholm at this kind of odd press room here. It's like a bit like a kind of closet cupboard, I believe. Yeah. So I'm here with John Sayer. John, could you start by introducing yourself, and then I'm going to move on to my...
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm John Sayer from Newcastle University in the United Kingdom. I'm an adult nephrologist with an interest in inherited kidney diseases.
Excellent. We have Roman. Roman, could you mind introducing yourself, please?
Sure. I'm Roman Müller. I'm a nephrologist, adult nephrologist as well in Cologne, Germany. I share similar interests with John in genetic kidney disease, and that's also part of my role here at the ERA.
So now that we are here at the ERA, I'd like to just point out the European Renal Association. What role does it play in forming our young nephrologists?
Yeah, I'll start if I may, because I came here to the ERA many years ago, actually when it was in Stockholm, I think 1998 or 99, and we'll have to check that. I saw this inspirational speaker at that meeting when I was a very junior researcher in nephrology, and the speaker's name was Friedhelm Hildebrandt, and I heard this amazing plenary talk by this physician talking about genes and the kidney and inherited kidney disease. And this is the first time actually that I was blown away by the sort of depth of knowledge of an individual and how far you could go down a route into kidney disease using the technologies that were emerging at the time for sequencing genes, etc. So as a junior player in nephrology, I was exposed to this great plenary talk that then inspired me to contact the speaker later on, and I ended up actually working for Friedhelm Hildebrandt in his lab in Michigan. So
he's
now in Harvard, but that was a great outcome because I came to an event. I wasn't an expert and I was inspired, and then I followed that path.
That's a great example. And Roman, how has the ERA impacted your career? Or you're quite involved in the actual organization as well, right?
Both indeed. I work here with the ERA specifically on genetic kidney disease together with John, actually, in the working group Genes and Kidney. Just got renamed. Previously had the less inspired name Working Group on Inherited Kidney Disorders. We felt that it needs to be shorter and nicer now, Genes and Kidney. So that's an essential part of my work, actually, and allows for a lot of networking and bringing people together and working together on this really important topic. And I think we all share the idea that while, you know, everybody thought 20 years ago genetic kidney disease is a rare thing, this has changed entirely. While its individual diseases may be rare, the entire entity of genetic kidney disease explains a large proportion of chronic kidney disease in general, and that's why this needs a lot of advocacy and work and guidance to the field as well. That's part of our role here. Now, when it gets to forming the new generation of nephrologists, both with an interest in genetic kidney disease, but in general, I totally share what John just said, right, and showed with his very nice personal example, that this is a perfect platform for networking and for allowing them to find mentors and find people with similar interests. And this is strongly advocated by ERA and has always been, and there's always, you know, the great role of YNP, so the platform for young nephrologists, which really helps them to get active and to be heard as well as an active voice in kidney disease in Europe. And that's a very important thing. We also in our own working group have YNP members, and they can early on join those boards as observers to learn and interact with people that have been longer in the field. And on top of that, there's even funding tools that allow them for exchange and going somewhere else, like fellowships, long-term fellowship. Just to give my example, I've just been awarded such a fellowship, not me personally, but a project that my lab proposed, and we'll have a young colleague from Mongolia joining later this year.
Mongolia.
So this really brings people together and allows people to see how things work somewhere else, obtain expertise. John just said he joined Friedhelm Hildebrandt back then, and this probably had a major impact on his career, and we hope this can be done for many more people through those fellowships as well.
It's actually through Friedhelm that I know John.
Yeah, and the other thing I'd say is the leadership of the ERA is evolving with this focus on genetics and rare disease. And I've just come from a pre-meeting on rare disease where the current president and the incoming president were both at that meeting. And that I think that signal from the top down that rare diseases are important for all nephrologists is really important. And I know on the organizing committee, I think Albert Ong was chair of this meeting's organizing committee. He's interested in cystic kidney disease and rare disease. And so it's permeating through the whole culture. And I think that's really exciting.
Great. Actually, that is a perfect phase into the next topic, which is rare diseases. You guys are both adult nephrologists interested in genetic diseases.
Hmm.
Isn't that sort of more typically the domain of pediatric nephrologists?
Used to be. That's a perception in the field still, and a misunderstanding probably. But it's quite clear how this occurs, right? I mean, genetic disease usually in disease in childhood plays a major role in early onset of diseases, and that's why this was noticed much earlier. And it's more easily noticed probably than in adults as well. So 20 years ago, I think most people would have said genetic testing in chronic kidney disease in adults, that doesn't play a role. The yield, the diagnostic yield is zero. These diseases don't occur, and they especially don't occur if there is a negative family history, then you don't even have to think about genetic disease. Now, this has completely changed, and that's still a transition in the field. That people that work with that every day, like John and me and all the others we interact with in our working group. However, for many other general nephrologists, this is not so clear yet in everyday life, and that's part of the role ERA plays to spread that knowledge and educate and get this idea out that genetic causes of kidney disease are really common among adults.
That's right. And so you're actually presenting about that, John. Perhaps you could go into that. Are you talking about NPHP1 loss in adult onset disease?
Yeah, so my reflections on pediatric versus adult nephrology is that, yeah, we see genetic diseases across the whole spectrum, but we got good, or our colleagues got good at identifying inherited diseases in children, but now we're observing the same phenotypes presenting later on in adult populations. So I'm describing some work I did in an adult population who had undiagnosed kidney disease, and when we looked for deletions in NPHP1, we found a large number of families that had that, and that actually explained their kidney phenotype and also extrarenal manifestations. And some of them, they had retinal degeneration and blindness. And, you know, once you have that diagnosis, it all fits together. But before then, you know, people are scratching their heads or haven't quite joined up the dots. So I think genetics does allow you to then optimize patients' care and management, because then you're dealing with the whole patient, the kidney, and all the other manifestations of disease.
So when does a doctor have to refer their patient to a geneticist? That's a key question.
I think that depends on which country you're in, I think. You need to train our nephrologists to have a basic understanding of genetics, because it's as we said, it's permeating across all disease spectrums. You know, there will be genetic variants that make diseases better or worse in common genetic diseases such as kidney disease and hypertension, but then there's monogenic diseases. But I think what we're currently doing in my unit is that we're involving clinical genetics very early on now in the process, both in terms of providing a diagnosis and then providing a management plan and cascade screening families once a diagnosis is made. So I think you have to work with your clinical genetic colleagues from early on, I think.
And is your experience similar?
My experience is similar, and this is getting more and more important. We may be limited in resources sometimes there, and that's why it's not that we, you know, would say, and there's other reasons as well, we just do a genetic test for everybody now. That probably is not the solution. But getting in touch early on, if you have a case in which you don't know exactly and can't say with 100% certainty, this is the diagnosis, right? And some people you may be able to do that without thinking about genetic disease, but often this is not the case. This needs an interdisciplinary discussion in a way, and an early interaction. And the there are indicators, right? But no exact thresholds. That'll change and has changed tremendously over time when you think about age is an indicator, right? And there may be age thresholds. In the past, I was told, when I was in medical school, I was told NPHP1 plays a role in kids and never in adults.
Yeah.
That this has changed completely through work, for example, done by John's group. And this will keep on changing.
Yeah.
But nowadays, you know, if you have cases of people that are not 85 years old and you're not 100% sure what the reason is, then in the vast majority, you're probably going to have to think about a genetic test at some point. And another indicator apart from age is family history. But while positive family history tells you think about genetics early, negative doesn't preclude genetic testing in any way. And then another, and that's an important point I'll actually talk about in a CME course today. Another area is extrarenal manifestations, right?
Yeah.
You have to get the full history and exam of your patient, because then you have indications that it may be genetic if you have extrarenal manifestations like blindness, hearing loss. And there's many more that
right.
We often miss because we ask about the kidney, but that doesn't necessarily help. And if you put these indicators together, you at least have an indication, this patient, I want to discuss that with somebody else who knows. And this contact is also important, because reading genetic reports isn't always simple for somebody without this background. So you need this interdisciplinary interaction to really make sense of what your patient has.
Absolutely. And also reading those and interpreting those reports is a real bear, right? And CNVs, or copy number variations, is one of the classic ones, because you can't pick it up
yeah
too easily. Can you talk about that briefly, John?
Yes, so I guess copy number variation is when you have either a duplication or a deletion in a genetic region, and that may or involve one gene or several genes and give rise to predicted syndromes. So, you know, a good example would be heterozygous deletion of HNF1-beta, which gives the renal cyst and diabetes syndrome. But along with that comes other manifestations. But detecting these copy number variants used to rely on a very targeted approach where you'd use what's called microarray to detect those regions of copy number loss or gain. But now everyone's moving towards whole exome and whole genome sequencing and pipeline for interrogating the data sets you get downstream from these genetic tests is still evolving. So our ability to call copy number changes with these large data sets is variable. And occasionally copy number variants that are of clinical significance can be overlooked because the pipeline doesn't see them. And so particularly when you've got an absence of a gene, we were talking about MPHP1 homozygous deletions, you've got a complete absence of genes. So the report will say, we didn't see any variants in that gene. That will be because the gene isn't there, and so no variants are there to be called. But it's realizing, okay, the complete absence of variants in that gene might actually provide a clue to saying this gene is deleted completely. And does that explain the symptoms?
And that really means as well, you know, your report can be negative, the disease can still be genetic. And that's an important idea because people tend to believe if I have a genetic report that says there is nothing, it's not a genetic disease.
Exactly.
No, you need to know whether this really answers the question for your specific patient. And if you're not sure, you need to discuss with the nephrogeneticist again, you know, is there something where we might be missing? There will always be things we're missing that we don't even know of, but there are a couple of these candidate genes for which we know it's quite likely that we're indeed missing them and we may need additional diagnostics if the pretest probability that it's a specific disease like NPHP1 or ADTKD, for example, tells us, you know, we really want to test that gene and then we may want to dig deeper, but that needs interaction.
Right, so now we know that a renal disease will affect roughly one-third of individuals as they grow old. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So, and how much of that do you think would a genetic contribution?
So I think about a third of that third is genetic.
That's enormous.
Yeah, so that is a huge
percentage. That's 1/9 of the world's population.
Yeah. And, you know, we're a product of our genes and our environment, and we are still learning what it means to carry a genetic variant. And, you know, we talk about genotype correlation, and we're still working out the nuances of that. Just because you carry a variant doesn't necessarily mean you will get the phenotype. And so this penetrance question across many genes, even common genes involved in kidney disease, that needs to be answered. So we are learning still about what makes the genetic change important.
And that is, you know, again, modulated by environmental conditions often as well. You're going to have one patient with the same variant, as another family member, and the disease course can be entirely different, and that's where penetrance and expressivity comes into play, and that may even be body weight or something like that.
Sure.
That completely changes outcome and makes people think the other person doesn't have the variant. And this misconception that if you have a variant, you have the disease, if you don't have it, you don't have the disease, that really is a difficult one, right? It's just not that simple. And that will also lead to the fact that we'll learn that more and more cases are actually based on genetic causes. And that needs awareness and needs us to think about testing, otherwise we won't find them.
Right, so I have two more questions. One is, what is the role of these large collaborations like the million genome projects or whatever, you know, gazillion? What is that added value there? And secondly, my last question is, what would your advice be to GPs, general practitioners, seeing patients having questions and not really knowing where to go or understand what to do next?
So I'll maybe talk about the large sequencing projects. So in the United Kingdom, there was this 100,000 genomes project. There are similar projects around the world. So Vanderbilt University in the USA just published a project called All of Us, which then is a large sequencing project across American populations. So what we're learning from these large sequencing projects is that the more patients you sequence, the more you learn. And, you know, our reference genome was based on a small number of patients from a limited number of ethnicities. Now that we're sequencing people for less cost. We can find out about different populations around the world, and so a rare variant in one population may be less rare in another, and so it takes the value of disease-causing variants into play, depending how common or rare they are. So I would say these sequencing projects are extremely valuable, extremely vital, because there's a benefit of providing a diagnosis to those that enter the study, but also providing a database for the rest of the world to compare their population to.
No, that is crucial, I'd say, right? And we're already learning that we have to reclassify some variants just because we have more knowledge now how this looks in the reference population and so on. And that makes clear that a genetic test is not always a yes or no answer, but really needs all of this background information. The collaboration is also truly important beyond sequencing, right? When each individual disease is rather rare, while the entire population with genetic kidney disease is large, doing clinical studies of any kind requires that international collaboration, and there societies like ERA play a very important role to link people.
Right, you can do trials within cohorts. Yeah. Too, and that sort of innovative approach, so important to discover new things.
Yeah.
So my last question was about GPs.
Yeah, we both dodged that one, didn't we? But
no.
So I think
struggle a little bit with that one.
So I think GPs obviously provide referrals to tertiary care, and I think GPs are extremely powerful in what they see and what they refer. But I think going forward, I'd like to see GPs having access to genetic tests so that then they can target their referrals to those that need it. And so you're getting over this barrier of this fear of, well, how do I send this test off and how will I interpret the results, needs to be overcome. And so I think the next generation of doctors need to, one, know how to handle large data sets and be coders and do R and Python scripts, but two, be not afraid of, you know, this new next generation of data that comes with every patient.
No, absolutely. And I mean, for now, the answer often still means, right, know the experts in your country and reach out. And I can only emphasize this again, reach out, let's discuss. And we usually find a solution, right? And we usually find an answer and interpret things together. In the future, this will have to be more widespread, the knowledge that won't work through referral all the time. But for now, reach out. And we have to be really much better than we were in the past, educating people also on prejudice towards genetic testing. And so there's still a lot of prejudice, and there's no reason for this, right? The society in general, we need to educate our GPs, nephrologists, everybody in the field, and we need to let patients know what this means and that this is nothing to be afraid of, to be talked about like any other test. We need to talk about it, right? We need to get agreement from the patient that we do a test, but that then it's a test like many others. And this also comes with concern about reimbursement, right? And often this is not even warranted. There is no concern, but the concern exists in the head of people, and that creates a high barrier towards testing. And there I can only talk about the German example, because that's really a national thing in the end.
Yeah.
But in Germany, there is much of the feeling, you know, that this is a problem with your own budget of your practice and so on, and that's why you don't necessarily do that. You can't really judge how much is the cost and is it a problem. It's no problem at all. It's quite official that you can refer your patient and send in your blood sample with your diagnostic question anytime, and it's no problem personally for your practice. But the feeling is out there that this might be the case, and that leads to the fact that, well, I don't really know, I don't touch this. And this will have to be changed, but it's about education.
Right. Do you think in the future we'll be taking whole genome sequencing from the heel prick?
Yeah, the heel prick, yeah. So this is actually a project that they're piloting in Birmingham in the United Kingdom, where newborn screening is being subjected to whole genomic sequencing. And the idea is that you sequence the baby's genome at birth, and then at different time points in their life, you apply different panels. So at birth, you'll apply the, you know, essentially the Guthrie test, the metabolic diseases that are really important early on in life. But at different life stages, you could apply a different panel. So I think it's exciting. It does have ethical consequences and other things to think about, resources and that, but it's the way forward.
This needs a discussion in parallel on the level of societies, right? So not medical societies, but actually the whole population, and everybody needs to be involved. We need to prepare people that this is coming, and we need to prepare ourselves and everybody for the ethical questions. We need, it's not about, you can't stop this process, and that doesn't make any sense because there are many advantages with it, but you need to face the ethical questions in parallel, and you need to prepare everybody for this. Otherwise, we end up in situations like with mRNA vaccines, where you certainly have a lot of prejudice that doesn't is not on solid grounds in any way.
Well, thank you for being my star panel on genes and kidneys. So, thank you both.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.